Greetings, new and regular listeners. I'm Lana, joining you for the next hour. This was a filmed interview, but this show is also available in audio format on redice.tv and redicemembers.com in the section for 314. This show will provide some tips on raising a large family. My guests are Jennifer Loken and Ayla. Both are mothers of six. They'll share some advice based on what they've discovered, things that can be helpful to new and expecting mothers. Jennifer and Ayla up next. Jennifer Loken, I'll start with you since you're new to the program. Say hello.
Hello, everybody.
And as I was saying off air, Loken kind of reminds me of Loki, the Norse god. I'm sure you guys talk about that at home a little bit, right?
We do.
Now, how many kids do you have?
I have six.
Okay, you have six.
15, and my youngest is six.
Nice, nice work. And then we also have Ayla, returning guest. Everyone knows wife with a purpose. Say hello, Ayla.
Hi, everybody.
And she just had her sixth baby.
Yes.
Well, fantastic. Yep. Well, I wanted to do the show because, you know, I did a video with Ayla. She issued a white baby challenge and a lot of people got excited about that. And then I met Jennifer here and she has six kids as well. And Ayla has six kids. So I wanted to maybe get some tips because I know there's a lot of young girls that are listening and they actually want to have large families. So if a young woman is listening, wants to start a big family, what is some advice you can offer her? Who wants to go first?
Ayla, you can go first. Okay, well, first of all, start young because you never know what's going to happen. I have lots of friends who tried to start having the first baby at like 20 or 21, found out they had fertility issues, needed like a little bit of medical help or needed to get on a better diet and kind of or do some cleansing or something to help that process along. We kind of live in a pretty toxic environment these days, and a lot of people have trouble conceiving. So don't put it off for sure. Like start the sooner the better. Start trying to have your family. That's my tip number one. My second tip, as far as if you're wanting to have a large family, the biggest expense I've found surrounding a large family is the medical costs and medical insurance. So you want to kind of be pre-planning for that. If your husband's in college or something like this, you want to be sure that he's aiming for a job that typically comes with fairly good health insurance to help mitigate that cost. So I think that those are two things that you can do as a young woman that can really kind of give you the right projectile into having a stable, large family.
Yeah, it's good that you mentioned the toxic environment. Exactly. I hear from a lot of women that have fertility issues, and I'm always saying, get your hormones checked. What endocrine disrupting chemicals are you using? What are you putting on your body? What makeup? What are you eating? All of those things will impact your fertility. And that's one thing when you go to a fertility clinic. They don't ask you any of those things. They're ready just to give you drugs. They're not asking about the things that you're putting on your body and ingesting, and that makes a huge difference. Certain herbs you can take, supplements you can take to help your egg health, so that's absolutely vital. Now, what about you, Jennifer? What tips do you have?
Well, I was an accidental, like, mother of a larger family. I didn't plan on it at 19. I wasn't even married, and I found out I was pregnant, and I was engaged though, so I did have that going for me. And we just decided to quickly throw together a wedding. And I actually was on various different birth controls. None of them worked though. So we were destined to be a big family. But I think like the big thing is learn to be mellow because your kids reflect your personality a lot of ways in a negative way. So be mellow. Like my husband and I, we both have a let it go kind of attitude, and our kids very much so reflect that, and they're easier to kind of negotiate with and to work with. So if you're going to be high strung, expect high strung children.
Yeah. And if you push too hard in one direction, they might actually rebel against that. So it's kind of a fine line, right?
Right. And, you know, I learned right away that, you know, you try like disciplining your kids how you were disciplined. And I learned right away that my children did not respond well to like the spanking that my parents used to do to me. And so I found actually, you know, takes time and effort, but it works better to actually explain to my kids the process and why. And it's a pain in the butt. And I, you know, talk them through all the processes of why they did something. And my husband kind of looks at it as like, you're kind of nagging, but you know, it kind of works.
But at the same time, you have to also apply discipline, because kids, they are always testing those boundaries. So you do have to let them know where those are, right?
Yeah. And so we do a lot of, you know, you're grounded from the computer.
Yeah, that's probably the worst thing you could do to kids in this day and age. I mean, when we were growing up, like, we didn't have that. Now little kids can go online and they can go look up, like, you know, pornography and things about sex. And like, we didn't have that kind of stuff when we were growing up, you know?
No, I kind of thank God that we didn't. So it was so much better when we didn't have that kind of stuff. So
One thing I always hear from people, especially white people, is it's too expensive having lots of kids. So I guess we'll start with you, Ayla. How do you tackle that question?
Well, basically, learn to live with less and learn to work with what you have. So first of all, I say, look at what your advantages are. What are your advantages? Do you have the talent that you could put into a home business? If you have that, that's great. You can have some extra income though there while mom stays home. Do you have maybe a family member who owns their own business and you can work for them or work with them, or your husband can have maybe a second job? Look at what is around you, or maybe you have an elderly grandmother who has passed away and she's given you $10,000 from her will, or $20,000. How can you best invest that instead of just going to Disneyland? So always be looking at your resources and what you have. We all have some sort of advantage. We all have some sort of privilege somewhere in our lives, and that we can take advantage of, and kind of try to maximize that, invest it, save it. And that's the second part, would be investing your money. So for me and my husband, when we get our tax return, it's not like, yay, we're going to go, you know, take an expensive trip or go out to an expensive meal or buy lots of presents. We're not into that. We're like, okay, what around the house can we invest in? Can we buy solar panels? Because then we're not going to have a power bill anymore, a very small power bill. You know, or can we upgrade something that adds value to our home? So we put in recently, I think it was last year's tax return, we used part of that to put in a really nice wooden playground. And that not only was something that my kids could enjoy, but it increased the value of our home a couple thousand dollars. So that was an easy thing to do, an easy place to put the money where we could use it, but we're going to have access to it later when we resell our home. And so those things are important. Also, just realizing that back in the old day, kids didn't have much and they were still happy and really fulfilled. In fact, probably more so than kids are today. So I always think of my dad. My dad was, he grew up in the South, and his father was an alcoholic and kind of took off on the family when my dad was 5. My dad was raised primarily by his grandparents because his mom had to go to the city to work to earn money. And it was kind of like, we don't have shoe money this year. So my dad would go a year without shoes, you know, or we don't have haircut money. So my dad's hair would get down to his shoulders before they'd be able to cut it. And certainly we don't want to live, you know, that destitute anymore, and there's no sense we have to do that. But just realizing that those kids turned out happy and healthy and functional, and our kids aren't going to die if they don't get a trip to Disneyland every year, or they don't get to go out to eat every week. And so cut back on those things. Cut back, you know, take modest and small vacations. So my family took a vacation just last weekend. We took a little mini vacation. We just went an hour away up to where there was still some snow on the mountains, stayed in a cabin. Only cost a couple $100, but the kids had a wonderful time. And so, you know, it totally beats going to some like grand ski resort or something really fancy. And cut back on those frivolous things, like, you know, don't go out to eat for every meal. You know, we go out to eat for special occasions, so birthdays mostly, or an anniversary. But we do have a lot of birthdays, so the kids do still get to go out to eat often, you know, with a family of 8. I mean, that's, you know, we're kind of averaging a little more than once a month, almost once a month. So vacations, out to eat, and then just those everyday expenses that people kind of hemorrhage their money into, like, you know, Starbucks coffees. Like, you don't need a Starbucks coffee every day. You don't have to go get like an $8 latte. You don't have to buy the newest issue of, you know, In Style magazine just because you saw it at the checkout store, and realizing that those things aren't going to fulfill you the way that children are anyways. So it's like, oh, you have your coffee, it's like $8 and it's over in like a half an hour. You get your magazine, oh, it's so exciting, but yeah, you read it in an hour and then you're done. If you invest that money in your family or into having more children, you're going to get so much more reward out of that than you are those like little tiny emotional, like, emotional buying things that we do.
Right. Yeah, I think like my family, I've learned how to cut all of our hair. So I do all of our haircuts, including my own. I haven't gone to a hairstylist in over 6 years. Yeah.
Oh, it looks good.
So, and then I cook most of the meals, and, you know, we eat out very rarely. And when we do, it's usually, how can we do this cheaply? So we do a lot of McDonald's, which is terrible.
Oh, no. Yeah.
But I figure if we do it twice a year, it's not the worst thing. And there's Bella.
Yeah, I see someone spying back there. They're always going to be someone spying.
Yep, they're always going to be a spyer.
So what are
and
some...
And there's God. Okay, we're downstairs.
It's like the BBC dad interview.
Oh, that's right. Terrible. Oh, jeez.
And you know, I swear they've been like taunting me for the past 2 days that they're like, we're going to go and we're going to...
that's good. You guys have some fun. Yeah. Yeah. The other thing I noticed too is people buy their kids a lot of clothes and kids outgrow them. You buy a baby and like 2 weeks later, they can outgrow something that you bought them, you know, and that lots of toys and things that they just don't need.
Do they have a better setup for this?
Yeah. For sure. We thrift shop everything that we can and we do hand-me-downs with everything that we can. And one of the benefits in being in like a church community, the way that we are, is that people in our church kind of, they know the ages of our kids. And so when they have, maybe their son leaves to go on a mission, they're like, oh, we have now all these, you know, nice dress shirts and nice slacks that he's not going to need for 2 years. He'll probably buy new stuff when he gets home. So they'll bring it over for me for my oldest son or somebody down the street, their daughters grow out of their nice dresses. And so they'll say, oh, let me go give that to Ayla and her family. So that's something really great too, is accepting lots of hand-me-downs and thrift shopping everything. Like we thrift shop everything that we can, pots and pans, dishes, clothing, you know, toys. Most, you know, even for Christmas, I will go to the thrift shop because like, if you're going to get a stuffed bear, for example, it doesn't have to be a brand new stuffed bear. You can find like a really nice one, usually with even the store tag still attached, at the thrift shop for literally like a quarter when you might spend $25 on that at like FAO Schwartz or something like that. So we thrift shop everything that we can. And my kids don't even, they can't tell the difference. They're just excited it's a new toy.
Right. Yeah, we do a lot of that too. And we do a lot of that like penny pinching stuff. It's like, no, we don't need that. You know, we kind of spend a little bit more on birthdays now that the kids are getting older. How old is your oldest, Ayla?
My oldest is 13. He'll be 14 in June.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that was like our chaos time. There's like a large chunk for like 3 years. I have zero memory, and it's because my husband thought it would be a good idea to own a business. And I had six kids, and I had, the oldest one was 8. And I was pregnant, and I have like 3 years where I'm like, I'm not really sure what happened.
Well, yeah, and I want to ask you guys about that because, you know, having large families, you have a marriage, and on top of it, you two are unique in the fact that you do videos, you know, you're active kind of fighting against this anti-whiteness that we have socially and politically, you show your face, you're out there. So how are you both managing to juggle all those things? Because it could be pretty intense. Jennifer, I guess we'll start with you because you're making videos too.
Yeah, I do the occasional video, and then a lot of, well, number one, like I, on my Facebook, I'm really selective who I let on that one because I post pictures of my kids there. Twitter, I don't post any pictures of my kids just because you don't want to give anybody any ammunition.
That's right.
And so, and then on my Instagram, I have it private too. So, you know, I can post pictures of my kids there, but I have a lot of videos of my kids actually on my YouTube channel, and I have, actually made them all unlisted and stuff like that because it just, even though a lot of them were just cute, you know, home video type things, but it's like there's too many weirdos out there. So yeah, my big thing is, it's my husband's always worried. He's like, you're gonna end up on a list. And I'm like, well, I kind of already was on a list because I used to contribute to a Free Patriot Press blog, and that one ended up on an Southern Poverty Law Center list. So
yeah. Well, that's where all the good people are on that list, you know? That's how I go find my guests now. I go to SPLC, and who do they hate? Okay, I'll have them on the show.
Yeah.
What about you, Ayla? How are you juggling it all?
Well, I just go through phases of what I can do. So when I first started making YouTube videos, my youngest was about 1 year old. So she was kind of in that stage where she was just toddling off on her own. She was already walking and she just wanted to kind of hang out with her brothers and sisters. And so I was able to kind of just sneak into the room and you know, shut the door and make a quick video. And my oldest was, you know, he's old enough to watch the younger ones now. So that helps out. You know, 5 years ago, I couldn't have done as many videos as I can now. So just kind of recognizing the timing and the seasons in my life. And so 2015, I was able to put out quite a few videos. And then like 2016, I was pregnant and I was also quite sick during a few periods of my pregnancy. So I didn't put out as much then. And I even took a break from Twitter last summer. I wasn't on for about 3 months. So I just kind of recognized those seasons and just go with the flow. And recently had a baby 3 months ago. So I knew I wasn't going to be, you know, up making videos the next day or anything like that. But he's just gotten to the age now where he hangs out really well with dad or with an older brother or whatever. So I can start doing things like this again. I can make my own videos. I can do interviews and that sort of thing. And so it just kind of just recognizing that cycle and taking advantage of the time that I do have and not sweating it when I don't have the extra time, realizing that my family is more important.
That's just it. Yeah. And I know you both watch the Duggar family and the Bates. And I know YouTube, I was just, you know, checking out some large families. There's a lot. They're mostly Mormons, but they have large families and they're basically filming their life and putting it out there on YouTube. And they're getting tons of views, lots of views. I mean, some of them have millions of views and it's just big families. People are so interested in it. I don't know, is it because it's become like a zoo exhibit to them, or on some level are they drawn to it? Why do you think that some of these shows have become so popular and people are fascinated by large families?
I think people honestly are just desperate to see a normal functioning family in this society. It's just kind of sick. I mean, but it's just kind of, you know, with the divorce rate and, you know, single motherhood and all this other stuff, there are just people out there who would just like to see a family that, you know, likes each other and actually likes to hang out. And I think that's a lot of it. You know, there's been speculation even with the snowflake culture, if a lot of it is just children who weren't properly bonded to their parents. And I think that that's probably a great possibility. You know, they're immediately, you know, whisked off to daycare so that the mom can go to work. And, you know, they just don't have that proper bonding. So everything becomes a threat to them. So, but I think a lot of it has to do with just they really like to watch families be families. And it's just nice.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think there's something natural. There's a natural instinct within us that wants to be part of a large, healthy, functioning family, no matter what the SJWs say. And even in the back in, you know, 2-3 generations ago, even if your mother for some reason couldn't have a lot of children, had a health issue or something, and you didn't come from a big family, you often had cousins and aunts and uncles who were, you know, closer to your age than they were your mom's, because your mom came from a big family. You had neighbors and you had this really amazing sense of community where you had all this multi-generational interaction going on and multi-age level interaction. And there's something instinctual inside of us that knows that to put a child in a system where they're sitting in a room with 30 other kids plus or minus their age by 6 months and one adult is not natural social interaction. And we kind of are, you know, we recoil at that a bit internally. And so then when we see a family just getting together on a Saturday morning making pancakes or whatever they're doing on their blog, and there's a lot, you know, there's the older ones are helping out and they're helping with the little ones, and the little ones are being cute and toddling around and getting into the syrup and all of these wonderful things that happen in big families, there is just a natural instinct that is drawn to that and people love it. And I kind of think about it like the way moths are drawn to light. And I think that big families, Christian families, wholesome families, healthy families, heterosexual families right now are like a light. And these SJWs and these poor millennials that grew up in households that were completely dysfunctional, they haven't ever seen it. And they see it and this like warm, attractive glow, and they just can't help but be attracted to it. And they can do it in one or two ways. They can do it in a nice way. Like there was, I believe it was like a Slate or BuzzFeed columnist a few years ago wrote about how she was obsessed with Mormon mom blogs and she didn't know why, but she loved them. Or they can do it in a negative way, which is what I get a lot on my Twitter and in the press, is like, oh my gosh, we have to like you know, it's a normal functioning, healthy family, and they don't hate themselves for being white, you know, like, let's throw Rotten Tomatoes at them. And so, but they have to react in some way. They're going to react with love or they're going to react with hate, but they're drawn to it. And so when people react with hate to me or my Twitter, my videos, whatever, I realize that they just want to be close. They want to be close to that light and warmth. Even if the only way they know how to be close is to be negative about it.
Right. They don't understand it.
Yeah. And it's interesting how, you know, people will complain on you all for having large families, but then there's Muslims coming into Europe and here that have 10 kids and no one ever complains on them, or Mexicans or Blacks. It seems like it's just European women that are really judged for having large families, when this is something that we always used to have, right?
Well, I posted a picture once, and it was Ivanka Trump, and she was holding her son on her lap, and she was doing some work and stuff like that. And I was like, this is what the left and feminists hate more than anything. You know, this beautiful, attractive, feminine woman sitting there nurturing her child. They absolutely cannot stand that. And it's because that's the quickest and easiest way to destroy the family union. And that's what they have to do, because that's the only way that they're policies have any credibility, is when you don't have children and generations who are properly bonded, and then they're totally indoctrinated into the school system too. So
yeah. Now, are you both, I know Ayla's homeschooling, but Jennifer, are you homeschooling kids or not?
I am. We're actually taking spring break right now, and I actually gave my kids the option. I'm like, okay, we could do school because I like the routine that it provides, or we need to seriously do some de-junking of our house. So we just do that. So, but
my
yeah.
kids would have picked school.
I wish they would have.
We did last spring break, we did our spring cleaning during spring break, and I tried to make it fun, and I had treats and I had music, a playlist all set up, and we did one room a day. And I thought that they got okay with it at the time, but then this spring break rolled around, they were like, we don't have to clean again, do we?
Yeah, see, for me, I'm pretty flashy that way. I'm kind of a clean freak. I like it orderly. I have a fascist household here, you know. But yeah, so do you put them to work? You make them do chores?
Yeah. I told my husband once, I'm like, you're so lucky I have so many kids, because I don't have time to be as tyrannical as I would about things around the house if I didn't have all the kids to keep me busy.
Yeah, I'm a neat freak, definitely. My dad was in the military, and before I was born, but he was in the military. My mother was a nurse. And so they were both like very shipshape. Everything had to be like completely sanitized and in its place and on time. And so I really got that from my parents. And I go a little nutty if things aren't totally clean. I'm pretty much a neat freak. But I've really worked a nice schedule for our family. So we do homeschool in the first part of the day. We're usually done around 1 or 2 o'clock if the day is going well. And then my kids do about a half hour of what we call deep cleaning. So we just rotate rooms every day. So Monday's the kitchen, Tuesday's the living room, Wednesday is outside chores, Thursday's the bathrooms, etc. And so they have their deep cleaning chores and their assignments, and they get those done. And then they can go off and run around the neighborhood and play with friends, or, you know, watch a show or do something like that. That's fun in the afternoon. But we definitely I have to have that routine going to keep my house clean, because kids are very messy. That's very true.
Yeah, it falls apart fast. And yeah, the routine has saved me, you know. I sitting down the beginning of the school year, I did a mission statement of what I actually wanted my goals to be with homeschooling. And that actually did a huge thing, because it's given me a goal and a vision to go for. And so, you know, when I buy books and the things that we go through, it's all, you know, directed towards that goal. And that's been really, really helpful for me, is just sitting down, writing it out, down, what do I want out of this? And, you know, I just don't want them to, you know, just not go to public school. It's like, no, I want them to be able to challenge every ideology out there. So, because it's important that they be able to contend for what is right. So.
Absolutely. Now, I also wanted to talk about home birthing versus hospital births. This is a topic that comes up a lot. Nowadays, it's quite scary what they do in the hospitals. If you kind of let them just do whatever they want to your baby, they'll put antibiotics in their eye. They give them artificial K vitamin shots instead of the natural stuff. They cut the cord too soon. They cut the penis, you know, they take the baby off and they have to measure them. And then they put them behind glass in some cases, just very unnatural things. So tell us a little bit about your births. Were they in hospitals or at home? What are some thoughts on how to do it correctly?
Mine were in the hospital, which I kind of sort of regret because I actually have like the ideal births for, you know, home births, because my births were so incredibly easy. In fact, they were so easy that the doctor wanted to film one of them for their Lamaze class.
Jeez.
And I kind of said no, because that's just too weird.
A little too personal, yeah.
Yeah. And then all my brother's friends, and they're all started having kids and having Lamaze class. I'm like, oh, thank God I didn't do that. But I had one, my fourth, you know, I got to the hospital. I was already dilated to a 7, and my husband looked at the nurse and he goes, you have about an hour to get everything together. And the nurse looked at him like, oh, you stupid idiot, what would you know? And exactly 55 minutes later, she shot into the scene. My doctor didn't even have time to get both gloves on. She was out. So, yeah. I wish I would have did a home birth, though, because I watched like the business of being born. I feel like I'm like, gosh, if only I like could have my kids with the brain that I have now.
Yeah, I know. No one teaches you these things. Most of our moms were in that generation where they didn't know a lot of the boomers. They just kind of surrendered to doctor authorities. And nowadays, I think women are better about it. I crack up because there's the skin to skin movement. It's like, this is ancient, taking the baby and putting it on your chest, skin to skin. Like, this is what women always did. But now it's a movement.
Again, yeah, this is hilarious. It's a movement. Yeah, I really wish I would have did a home birth, though. But yeah, I did. I made all the mistakes with my first three. I just did everything that I was told to do. So we did the vaccines, and we had lots of repercussions from that. Yeah. My oldest had a petite seizure. Yeah. And then we had like 9 serious, a week long reactions with the older three with each round of their shots. And it was like, this is dumb, delayed development. We suspected autism with my second one because he just zoned out and he just didn't do anything, and they didn't like my older three, they none of them walked till they were past the age of 2, and the third one, he didn't walk till he was almost 3. So, and we quit vaccinating.
Yeah.
And they were fine. So it was like, this is so dumb because you just don't know any better.
Yeah, they put all kinds of toxic fillers and junk in there that's just really bad, metals and just And especially when a baby's just born, they're so gentle, and right away they want to poke them and snip them and cut them and like do all these things. I mean, it's frightening. What do you think, Ayla? Tell us about some of your births.
Yeah, so I had my first 5 at home, and I had studied midwifery for quite a few years before I had my first son. So I had already had a midwife that I had worked with a few times and things like that. And so I had the first 5 at home, and then my 6th one, I had a couple of medical issues, so I needed to have him. I might could have had him at home, but it was just a little bit riskier, so we decided, and kind of, I was also kind of curious about the hospital, and we actually have a really great hospital here where I live, so I thought, well, let's try hospital, and so I had a midwife in a hospital for my most recent one, and actually had a really great experience. They were really hip to not doing the things I didn't want them to do. So we didn't do vaccines. We didn't do the drops in the eyes. We didn't do the K shot. You know, they waited to cut the umbilical cord. The midwife let my husband catch our son, because my husband had caught our other babies at home. And it was kind of like a tradition we had that dad catches them when they come out. And so the midwife was like, yeah, totally. You know, she was kind of, she actually barely made it there as well. Jennifer was saying with her doctor barely making it there. But when I was in the hospital, I said, you know, I have really fast labors. And they're like, sure. Yeah, you know. And when I was at about a 7, I was like, you really need to call the midwife, because it was in the middle of the night. They're like, oh, we'll wait. And I'm like, no, you really need to call her. And she kind of, barely slid in there in time. I was already pushing. They told me to stop pushing. And I was like, that's not going to happen. I told the nurses, I've had the other 5 at home. I don't care if the midwife is here or not. I am pushing this baby out. She can come or not. My husband can catch the baby. I don't care. So it was really funny. So she got there, but then she stepped aside and said, you know, there you go. You do it. And, you know, and so that was really great. We got to keep that tradition up. And I actually had a really wonderful hospital experience. But I know that 13, 14 years ago, when I first started having children, hospitals were still that kind of cultural shift hadn't happened in a lot of hospitals. They were still very militaristic about all of the procedures and the poking and the cutting, as you say. So yeah, we home birth, we don't vaccinate, we don't circumcise, you know, all that good stuff. And we've not had any major medical issues, thank goodness.
That's so great too. I hear that after, you know, 4, 5, and 6, it actually is easier. A woman's body's more acclimated and the births are easier. Is that true or not necessarily?
I have found... Oh, go ahead.
I had weird complications with my 4th pregnancy. My 5th pregnancy. I walked up the stairs and it was short stairs too. And I heard what sounded like a rubber band snap inside my body. And I guess my body releases too much of the relaxant hormone. And so I got what's called pubic symphysis dysfunction, which my pubic bone ripped apart. And that's what I heard, was the ligaments actually snapping apart between my pubic bone. And so that's why I actually only have 6, because I would still be having kids if I didn't have this complication. And that happened in September, and she wasn't born to almost December. And then the 6th one, it happened when I was 6 weeks along. Like, I found out and I was pregnant, and then a week later I heard it. Mm. And it was just incredibly painful. And I was an incredibly horrible wife and mother for the 9 months, because I was in so much pain. And I was just, I remember, like, with my 6th child, my kitchen floor got so dirty and I couldn't handle it anymore. I was like, nobody can see this. And it took me 2 hours to scrub it, and I couldn't move for 2 days afterwards because it hurt. So,
no more babies for you then, right?
You're, no more babies all done. For me. Yeah, I would still be having them if I didn't have that complication, because the doctor pretty much said you're risking your entire pelvic floor ripping apart. Oh, with each pregnancy.
Yeah, and as you said, birth control pills don't work. And, you know, there's a lot of research out there. There's a lot of nasty stuff in birth control pills that are actually cancer-causing and horrible for you. It's better to just know your natural rhythms, know your fertile days and chart. I mean, that's what they did in the old days. That's one thing I appreciated about a lot of the pre-Christian traditions. It evolved around, you know, fertility cycles a lot of the time, and women were more in touch with that. And I think they've kind of lost. Some women don't even know their fertile days. They're just,
yeah, you know. they don't even know when they're going to get their period, let alone that there is a time where you're going to be fertile. So, but yeah, it was pretty nasty. So, but
sorry to hear. Well, Ayla, how about you? Are you just going to keep having kids till you can't anymore? I mean, women in my family have been very fertile. I mean, they have kids till they're 45, no problem. So, I mean, yeah. When are you going to stop?
That was our plan, but we have to stop as well. I have hypertension that I deal with. Normally, when I'm not pregnant or haven't just had a baby, my blood pressure is fine. But with my past 2 pregnancies, right after I have the baby, about 3 days later, my blood pressure just goes through the roof. Last time, on my 5th baby, it was controlled by some simple medications. I took medications for about 6 months. Then I was able to switch to just herbs. Then I was able to go off of them completely, and my blood pressure was fine. But this time, my blood pressure was fine during my pregnancy. But again, just like the last time, 3 days after he was born, my blood pressure went through the roof. This time it was even higher, and it's still not controlled by medication. I'm on an incredibly high dose of medication and taking tons of herbs, doing all the natural things, using essential oils, relaxation techniques, all of this. And it's still very, very high. And so my doctor basically said, or my midwife, I should say, you know, said you're risking stroke or seizure if you have another one, because this seems to be a problem that is getting worse with each child. So whereas I would love to have another one, we're going to have to be done as well. But we're very seriously considering adoption, though how and the logistics of that are very complicated. But we definitely would love to do that in the future. So we'll just have to see what happens.
But not from Africa or Asia. No. Or, right? Let's just get that straight.
We would probably want to foster adopt within the United States, you know, and get some of the kids here in the U.S. some good homes first. But that's a ways off because I would want my youngest to at least. Yeah, I would want my youngest to at least be old enough to have been well established in our family culture and have a really good sense of himself before we introduce somebody else into our family who's going to have, you know, come from a different background, different environment, different genetics and all of this sort of thing. And then like we could focus more on that child and getting that child what they need because, you know, they come from. Obviously, they come from bad situations and shaky backgrounds. So we would want to be able to help that child as much as possible. So anyways, this is a ways off. I'd probably want my youngest to be at least around 10 years old before we do this, maybe 7 to 10 years old, depending on his personality. But yeah, not Africa or Asia. We want to take care of American kids first.
That's right. And you know, generally, I think kids that grow up in large families, they tend to have less kids. At least that's what I've seen. And then a lot of the kids that grow up where they're the only child, then they tend to want to have a lot of kids. What do you guys think about that? Do you think that that dynamic's going to play in your family that, you know, some of the kids are tired of taking care of their brothers and sisters, so they're not going to want to have kids in the future or not as many?
I think it's all about how you frame it. I think it's about your family culture. So in my family culture, we love babies and we kind of pass that love down to our kids. And we really try to model that for our older children in particular. And our older children do have a lot of responsibility. Being the oldest, we ask for their help quite often. But like my oldest, for example, like he cannot wait to get married and have his own kids. Like he's all about babies and all about little kids. He just loves helping. He loves taking them out and pushing them on the swing or helping out. And so I think, and then our oldest daughter, who's 4, is always telling us she's going to have 10 babies. She's obsessed with baby dolls, loves babies. My husband came from a really large family, including his step siblings. He came from a family of 11. So he wanted to have a large family. So I don't think it's always the case with large families that they want to have a smaller family. I think it's all about how it's framed. If your family acts like the new baby is a burden and that it's difficult to take care of it. So if mom is kind of slumping around the house in her pajamas, like, oh, you know, the baby kept me up again all night, or you're making it a negative experience and not looking at the positives and the blessings of it, then the kids are going to kind of internalize that as more of a negative experience. But if they're used to looking at the blessings of having a new baby or a toddler or a young child in the house, then they're really going to be enthusiastic about having a large family themselves.
Yeah, I had, let's see, 2 older sisters and 3 younger brothers. And so I came from a larger family. I'm actually a second generation homeschooler because my parents homeschooled us when, even back in the day when it was in North Dakota, it was completely illegal to homeschool.
It was?
So,
wow.
Yeah, when they started, in fact, they were part of the movement that got it legalized in the state of North Dakota. So let's see, it was mid-80s, it would have been mid-80s, early 90s. Hmm. So they actually helped get the law changed. I remember going to lots of, you know, congressional hearings and court things and stuff. And there was just always this kind of this, you can't go outside till after 3 kind of a thing. Cause nobody could see us outside cause they were paranoid of that, you know, somebody would call in and say
children's
that we were
services or something. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I know like one family in my area, they have 13 kids and only 7 of them are married. And I think that they are almost going to have 44 grandchildren and the oldest one's 15.
That's great. That's great.
So, and yeah, wow. I mean, she's younger than me and she just had baby number 9, one of their kids. So they are just popping them out, and I just am like, yeah, I go.
Especially if they're cool people, you know, if they're great people, they're smart, they're good looking. Like, we want those people having lots of kids, right? Of course.
Yeah, and they all homeschool too, which is even better because then you're getting away from that state.
Exactly, they won't be programmed. Now, Ayla, earlier you brought up sleep. Let's talk about some tips for, you know, you just bring your baby home. Some people say never wake the baby. Some people say let him sleep. Some people say you need to wake him up every few hours to constantly feed them. Some people put them in the bed. Some people put them down the hall. Now, what are some tips? We'll start with Ayla.
Well, I've always co-slept. So I definitely recommend moms that are having their first baby to pick up a couple books or just kind of look around online and learn about co-sleeping, learn about how to do it safely, and learn about the benefits of it and kind of get used to that idea because it's a lifesaver. So I basically sleep with my babies. They sleep in the crook of my arm. They nurse. Then we change the other side, then change the other side a couple of hours later, and it works marvelously for us. And I'm typically not sleep deprived. I've had wonderful sleeping babies. As far as nap schedules, I've always been a really big fan of letting the kids kind of choose their own schedule as far as napping goes. And as a mom, you'll kind of be able to see the pattern. So maybe if your baby is a couple months old and they're starting to like sleep from like 6 to 8, and then that's keeping them up until midnight. Like, definitely, you probably want to try to gently rework their schedule by waking them up, or maybe letting them only sleep like 15 minutes around 6 o'clock and then trying to wake them up or something like that, in order to get them on a better rhythm. And I've also noticed I did a lot of visualization when I was pregnant. So, when I was pregnant and I was getting ready to go to sleep, I would like just think, like, this is sleeping time, this is calm time, and try to like get my baby in that rhythm of now is time to calm down, now is time to wake up, now is time to calm down, now is time to wake up. And I don't have any empirical evidence as far as whether or not that actually scientifically works, but I know that my kids have been great sleepers, so I definitely recommend at least trying that toward the end of your pregnancy, for about 7 months on. And then as far as waking them to eat, I've never found that to be needful unless you're battling like maybe a breast infection, like a mastitis, and you really need them to nurse really regularly or something like that. In that case, I would probably just buy a breast pump. So I always just let my babies eat when they're hungry. And that's worked the best for us.
Yeah, I guess I did it the same way, where I just kind of am like, yeah, you know, go with the baby. I think part of that helps is that we're stay-at-home moms, and so we can just kind of be flexible like that, where, you know, if you're going to be sending your kids off to daycare, I could see you needing to get them more on a schedule and a routine so that it works out better that way. But yeah, we just always were kind of laid back about it. You know, I think like my oldest, we tried the crib thing, and it just was like a complete miserable thing trying to get her to sleep in her crib. So we just kind of gave up on that. We even tried like the bassinet next to the bed, you know, because you want to be the responsible parent. And it just never worked for us. It was just like, it just worked better just to bring them in our bed. My husband, he wasn't crazy about it, because he's like, I'm going to roll over on and crush them or something. And it never happened.
Yeah.
So, but he was convinced he would. So, but.
Yeah, they have a like little Dock-a-Tots, even Snuggle Me Organic. There's all kinds of really neat things you can buy that it almost like mimics the womb. It's like this mini kind of baby mat, almost like a pad or I don't know, a piece of fabric. I don't know how do I explain it. You just have to check it out. Snuggle Me Organic, and it hugs the baby. It kind of falls into it, and then you can lay right between you in the bed, which is cool. So no one has to worry about squishing the baby. But yeah, like we were talking about before. In the old days, they didn't do this. They lived in small little houses. They didn't have a whole room just dedicated to the baby down the halls that they can put him in. And it was so cold, too. They all needed to sleep together in the same bed, right?
Yep. Pilgrims, they all slept in the same bed, and they all had 10 kids. It was just how it was, and it worked. Mm-hmm. So, and granted, you know, the child mortality rate wasn't the greatest, which is why they had so many kids, but at the same time, it was like, you know, it's how it was done. You know, families bonded together. They actually hung out together. They did things together. So I think that's like the funniest thing for me is people who are fascinated that we do like home meals. That's fascinating to them. It's like, I make a point that we have at least, you know, 3 good family meals a week together. Friday, it falls apart because we do pizza movie. So, and then Wednesday we have church, but.
Yeah, let's talk about food tips. I mean, you know, cooking for a big family, it's a lot. So what kind of tips do you have for people cooking? Some ideas maybe.
Crock pots are your best friend.
Definitely.
You can get it going. You can do school, and you're by the end of the day when you're like burnt out and you're just kind of like, I don't care anymore. It's already there and done. I love my crock pot.
Yeah, I have to agree with that, definitely. And then I also think we garden a lot, so we grow a lot of our own food, and that helps. And to have a schedule, to have a meal schedule, really saves me, because I know that, you know, on this day I need to get, you know, dinner in the crock pot early. I need to get it in at, you know, 10 o'clock or whatever to make sure it's on time. And you get in that rhythm, and it almost feels like, you know, you don't have to remember. It almost feels effortless when you're in a rhythm, because your body and your mind are used to doing these things. And so it's like, okay, Wednesday night is, you know, chicken soup, or yeah, like yeah. you were saying, Friday night is pizza. Like if you're in a rhythm, that works really well. And then with our garden, what I love to do, because you kind of can't plan like what's going to be ripe or what's coming out of your garden at like exactly the right time. So what I like to do is have a base food for each night of the week, like Thursday night is rice, or, you know, or like Wednesday night is pasta or something like this. And then I add to it whatever vegetables and things we're getting out of the garden that day. And then I just keep some like frozen veggies or canned veggies in my cupboard and my freezer in case for some reason, like, you know, we had some kind of disaster happen in the garden that day or the week before, and, you know, now this zucchini harvest we were planning on didn't happen, or, you know, something like that. I've got a backup that I can easily just, you know, throw in and work in with dinner. But definitely you got to schedule those meals and schedule the prep work too. The way I do it, you know, we have our breakfast, lunch, and dinner schedule. And then after the dinner section on my paper, I have prep work for the next day. So maybe we're having muesli for breakfast. My kids really love like Swiss muesli, like the kind you soak overnight. They're like authentic kind. So I, you know, I have to put that, get that prepared the night before for breakfast the next morning. But it saves me so much money, because to make my own Swiss muesli is so much cheaper than box cereal. And it's so much healthier for my kids. And if I just have that little schedule and know to do it ahead of time, it saves me time and it saves me tons of money, and we're way healthier for it.
Yeah, having a garden is great. Also, if your husband's hunt, because you can catch a big animal and that lasts for a long time. That's one thing that always pains me when I see some of these big families. When they go grocery shopping, they buy a lot of crap, a lot of carbs, a lot of Topper ramen, a lot of cheap stuff, cheap soda, and that's poison for your kids, you know. But it's expensive doing low carb unless you can hunt, unless you can have a garden, right?
I have a garden. We do a garden too. We haven't been able to do anything with it because the ground's pretty frozen right now still. But yeah, my husband hunts. In fact, my 15-year-old daughter, she got a deer last year, so it was her second one that she
nice.
Got. So that was
nice.
Kind of cool. So yeah, so we're
yeah,
kinda
definitely. Excited. And I think with food too is, again, you have to recognize your rhythms and your seasons of life. So what, like right after I've had a baby, we're going to be eating some junk food. You know, I'm not going to be up cooking a meal from scratch right after having a baby. So I realized that first month or two after I have a baby, we're going to be eating some boxed things. We're going to be eating from cans, especially if it's during the winter. So our garden isn't producing much, you know, but maybe two cabbages a week or something. And so just recognizing that it's okay, it's temporary. Or if you have a financial setback, you know, your husband loses his job and you say, okay, look, we have a big family and we can't afford organic fresh food right now. And we're going to do some mac and cheese for a little while. And this is just a temporary measure to get us over this hump. And then we can go back to being healthy. And I think the important thing is to not overstress yourself about it. And when you have only one or two kids, it, you know, when my family was smaller, it was a lot easier to be more consistent with the healthy food. But once you have a large family, you have to realize that there's, you know, there's eight people, there's eight different needs. There's people who are sick and people who are well, and, you know, all of these different things that have happened. And to just go ahead and relax a little about it, and realize that a little bit of junk food isn't going to hurt, particularly if most of the time you're putting in the effort to cook good, wholesome food from scratch.
Yeah, and if you can afford it, Whole Foods actually has a lot of good things in their freezer section that isn't toxic and bad too. You know, some people can afford that.
Yeah, right. You know, I watch a lot of Jordan Peterson, and I didn't really realize a lot of the stuff that he talks about with raising kids that I kind of already do. Like, I kind of do this thing where I only cook one meal a day. my kids are responsible for making sure that they eat the rest of the day. I make a nice meal at dinner and that's it. And if they are hungry, they need to learn to make themselves a sandwich. And so like my 6-year-old, she already knows how to make a sandwich and, you know, she'll help make macaroni and cheese and she's learning out all these things that she can do because, you know, you want to do as little for your kids as soon as possible so that they learn how to do it for themselves. So that's big part.
That's a really good point. Yeah, that's an excellent point. I really agree with that. I have my kids cook a lot of the meals too.
Yeah. You got to teach them how to be self-sufficient, even the boys, because let's face it, when they grow up, you know, a girl doesn't want to meet a guy who like can't even make mac and cheese, right? I don't think moms do service when they're also serving their children and doing every little thing for them, because it tends to make kind of mama's boys too, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, I always say that my kids are going to be a steal, particularly my two oldest boys, because they know how to change a baby. I mean, heck, they've been at so many home births. They know how to deliver a baby. Wow. They can deliver a baby. They can change a baby. They know, you know, different nursing positions that are best when a baby's crying. They know how to do their laundry. They know how to cook, you know, a 3-course meal, 4-course meal. They know how to potty train a toddler because they're helping me with all of these things. And so whoever the girls that get to marry my two oldest boys in particular are going to be incredibly lucky because they're already going to know all of these things.
See, that's awesome.
Right. So, but yeah, I mean, I just kind of take like a hands-off approach a lot of times with a lot of stuff with, you know, chores and stuff like that. Although it does help that my fourth child is very OCD and like her favorite thing to do is clean and organize things. Nice. And that's actually her love language is acts of service like that. So like, if I really want to make her happy, I'll make a grocery list before we go to the store and she gets to man the list. And that's just makes her happy as can be.
Oh, that's nice.
You make a list? Like, yes. Happy birthday, sweetie.
Well, before we wrap up, is there any other last tips that you want to give people or anything that you want to share about your way that you raise your families? Jennifer, I guess we'll start with you.
Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to have kids. Don't be afraid. Don't let society convince you that, you know, kids are these terrible burdens. They're not. They are blessings and they are really, really fun. They make me laugh all the time. Don't be afraid to have kids. They are awesome. They are way cooler than most adults. I hate to say that, but, you know, they are. They're better. So, yeah, I just don't be afraid. Try it. You know, you'll never regret it, but you will regret not doing it.
Yes, and I would say don't be afraid of getting to know your deep inner self because one of my favorite phrases is children don't change who they are, they reveal who you are. And you have no idea how selfish or bad-tempered you can be until you have a child testing that, but it is an amazing way to develop yourself. You will grow so much. You'll look back on your pre-child self and say, I can't believe I ever thought that way, or I can't believe I ever acted that way. And it matures you so much. And so be comfortable, allow that process to happen. And I love what Jen said, don't be afraid, jump in and do it. Because at the end of the day, that is what we're here for. There really is. I mean, is to have children. I mean, do you, at the end of your life, what do you want to be surrounded by? Do you want to be surrounded by children and grandchildren and your great grandchildren? Or do you want to be surrounded by your old work colleagues? You know, my dad was a business guy where he worked in an office. He had lots of women in that office who chose not to have children. And now they're aging. They're in their 60s and 70s. They're going through health issues. And they don't have a family there to help them. They have like my dad. Like, thank goodness my dad is like a really stand-up guy who would help anybody with anything. But they have their coworkers. Mm. That's the best that they have. And so really know that you're investing in the future. And my last tip would be don't be afraid of that third child. Because when you have one child, your life can stay really similar to what you were used to before having children. When you have two children, you are a fam, like a total, like 100% mom. At that point, you don't have times when like, just like when you have one child, they nap. And so then like your life suddenly reverts back to normal for a minute. But when you have two kids, they're not napping at the same times. They're not doing the same thing. So suddenly you are 100% a mom and it takes 100% of your effort. And so people will have two kids and then they get scared because going from 0 to 1 wasn't very hard. But 1 to 2, like, feels like your world is falling apart for a little while. hang in there. Don't be afraid to have that third kid, because the third kid is easy peasy, no problem. And after that, you can almost always add more, and it's no additional stress. Just don't be afraid at that two-kid mark.
I think it's better, too, because they have siblings to play with. Some of these parents that just have the one kid, it turns kind of neurotic, if you know what I mean. They're just, like, obsessed about this one kid all the time, and the kid doesn't have anyone else to play with.
Yeah, right. Very true. Yeah.
Now the third child, he was my third child was my biggest child that I had. And, you know, the big joke is when I was pushing him out, I screamed. And my husband says, shh. And I'm like, I'm supposed to do this with dignity and class here? So he had like a 14 centimeter head. You know, he was just huge. And he was like almost 24 inches long. And so he like literally, my water broke at home, like in that 15% chance, it was the gush all over. And I was like, thank God I still got kids in diapers, because mommy needs them. Because I had to wait an hour for Mike to get home, because he was an hour away. So, because it was a mess all over. And I was like, well, that laundry's not getting done now.
you brought up something I forgot to mention, though, before we wrap up. Diapers. There's a lot of diapers that are, like, awfully toxic. So that's another area.
Loves diapers. Loves kids' diaper. Their butts actually bleed, because, you know, you just try different ones, and they're so fragrant that they were brutal.
These Danish ones called Bambo, which is the best on the market, and they're not that much more money, but it's worth it to protect your kid, because there's all these amazing toxic chemicals in there, and when the kid wets itself, their pores open, it goes right in, and then they have these diaper rashes, and then they put more chemicals on the diaper rashes, and they're eating this bad formula. It's amazing that some of our kids survive, you know, seriously.
Yeah, I would recommend for people thinking about diapers to look into elimination communication. I don't know if either of you have heard of that before, but I did it with my first three, and that is basically where you read the techniques on how to do it, but you recognize when a baby's about to pee or poo, because they do give signals. And if you're tuned into that, you can actually go and hold them over the toilet. And so, like, my oldest, because he was my first and my only, and I was able to put a lot of energy into him, he didn't wear diapers. We just did elimination communication. I think maybe we had two accidents his entire childhood or babyhood. Wow. And so that is a really great option. If you have a big spacing between two kids, or you only have like the one or two kids, or the first three kids or so, elimination communication can be really great. It saves you money on diapers, saves you on doing laundry if you're doing cloth, and it's really neat.
I guess with my youngest two, they basically potty train themselves, because at that point I had learned, like, this is such a pointless struggle. They don't go, and they're not going to do this. Like, I have a video of my second one. It's on YouTube, but it's unlisted. But he's sitting on the toilet, and we're doing the potty negotiation. And he's like, why not just change my diaper? It's like, but he has the most pitiful face, and he's just devastated, and he's just like, why not just change my diaper? And it's just like, because you're too old for this. And we way too much time just sitting in the bathroom negotiating with them.
Ayla, you brought up some signals. So for people who want to try the method that you mentioned, what are some of the signals that they give off?
Yeah. Okay. Well, you have to kind of get in tune with what your baby in particular does, but usually they just start, I call it fidgeting. I don't know if there's another word, but it's when they kind of just start doing this, like you're holding them and they're perfectly calm and still, and then all of a sudden they just start squirming like this. And a lot of times they'll also try to make eye contact with you, even from a very young age. They'll kind of try to, you know, they have a hard time focusing, but they'll look around and they'll try to be looking for your face, and they'll be fidgeting like this. And then, that's a really, really good signal. And then also, if you just offer to take them to the bathroom, like every hour and a half, they'll get in the rhythm of being able to hold it. Like, and they'll just naturally want to hold it. Most babies. Now this, I don't know if it works on all babies, but it worked really well on my first couple of kids. So my oldest son, I would just take him to the potty about every hour and a half or so. And he just got used to going then. So that's when he went. And then you make a sound when they do go to the bathroom. So at the very beginning, when you're first trying this out, you put them in cloth with no cover so you can see when they start peeing. And the second they start peeing or pooing, you make a noise. So our noise was pss, pss. I don't know if that's picking up on the mic, but it's yeah. pss, pss, like a pee sound. And then they start associating that sound with, you know, urinating or pooing. And so then you can hold them over the toilet and make that sound, and they have, you know, kind of like Pavlov's dog, right? They'll pee when they hear that noise because they know, oh, that's the pee noise or that's the poo noise. And so if you just do that and you keep their bladder and bowel relatively empty, you know, you don't even have to look for the cue signals as much. But definitely when they first wake up, and if they're sleeping and they start fidgeting, or if they're awake and they start fidgeting, those are they're trying to make eye contact with you. Those are some really important cues.
Awesome. I think you both have shared a lot of great tips. I'm glad that we can do this. For people, Jennifer, that want to see your YouTube and reach you on Twitter, give out that information.
My Twitter handle is @intelligence with a J for the J sound. And then my YouTube is just Jennifer Loken. And then I have a Facebook group for my political stuff called The Rational Redhead. I'm eventually going to get a website. My husband's working on it. So I still have to finish the description, though, of that, so that he can get all that implemented. Because imagine that rationalredhead.com wasn't taken.
Wow, that's amazing. I was amused. I think someone was doing a handstand in the back, like walking on their hands. That was impressive.
Yeah, she's my type A, and she actually kind of gets, like, anxious if she has to be standing on her feet for too long. And she actually kind of starts to panic, like, even when we're shopping, she's like, I need to do something.
She's so showing off for sure.
She should be in gymnastics, but my husband, with his job, he's not too crazy about gymnastics. He designs medical equipment for quadriplegics and paraplegics.
Oh, wow.
So
wow.
He's like, gymnastics is the worst sport ever.
So. Now, Ayla, most people know you, but why don't you give out your information once again for newcomers?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter @apurposefulwife. And if you check my pinned tweet right now, I have all of my other contact information. I have a Facebook page, an Instagram, a Patreon, and then my YouTube channel is also there. But my YouTube channel is youtube.com/users/adorableayla, and Ayla spelled A-Y-L-A.
That's great. I didn't know you had a Patreon. That's great, everyone. Support her. She does some good work, and she has a big family, so definitely pitch into that. Well, thank you, ladies, so much. We'll have to do this again sometime in the future.
Yeah,
it's been fun.
That would be fun.
Yes, for sure. Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
If you enjoy my show, please support it. The best way is to sign up for a membership at redicemembers.com. From there, you can stream or download all my previous shows, and also catch me during our live TV show, Weekend Warrior, broadcasting most Saturdays exclusively for members. Or if you prefer, you can donate at paypal.me/redice. Thank you for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel. We'll talk again soon.